You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, presented by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool.
I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week. So we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
That's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Rob Hatch.
Hello, hello.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello.
Lionel, you're not very happy at the order that I introduced you in there. Is that the problem?
No comment, but you'll be hearing from my lawyer.
Rob, it's great to have you back after we had Ned Bolting last week. You've been commentating on extreme kayaking, among other things, but I know you're watching the Tour of Lombardy, Il Lombardia, as we're supposed to call it now, but we'll call it the Tour of Lombardy. The last monument of the season. A few people commented that we didn't really preview the Tour of Lombardy in last week's podcast. We did mention it briefly that it was going to be on British Eurosport, but we didn't talk about the race because we don't like speculation, do we, Lionel?
Well, no, and also the Tour of Lombardy, Il Lombardia, I think if you'd pinned me down, it's easy to say in hindsight, but if you'd said who's going to win it, I think Vincenzo Nibali would have been very high up, or Alejandro Valverde, who was fourth. It's always a race that has really quite a small number of potential winners, and it's not necessarily a big surprise that Valverde was up there and Nibali was up there. Well, Nibali needed something to salvage not a terrible season, but a season that's been dogged by sort of bad publicity and hanging onto the car at the Vuelta and a pretty poor Tour de France and all that.
Yeah, as I say, we're going to talk about the Tour of Lombardy in a moment. In the final part of today's podcast, we'll hear from David Miller. I did a series of events with David Miller last week throughout Britain to publicise his new book, The Racer, which is a follow-up to his autobiography, Racing Through the Dark. As the title suggests, it's more about being a professional bike racer. It's excellently well-written, as you'd expect from Miller. And it really takes you inside the world of pro cycling, while also he has quite an unusual gift to be able to stand back from it and realise the absurdity of it as well. So it's a book that I think a lot of people will get a lot out of, and he spoke extremely well about it last week. We're going to hear a little bit from an event that we did in Manchester together, and the rest of that event, which was all recorded, will be put out as a friend special podcast. Become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. And the full show, over an hour long, with some very interesting stuff in it, will be broadcast or released very soon. So let's start off with the Tour of Lombardy, Il Lombardia. Il Lombardia.
Lombardia.
Lombardia. Vincenzo Nibali was the winner.
Yeah, he was.
Did you see it, Rob?
Yeah, so the end of it, so the last 30 kilometres or so. Really good win. I think he came into it with some fantastic form. He had those wins last week. We talked him up for the Worlds as well because he was having podium places in those Coppa Italia races at the end of the year. Good form. Obviously, plenty of motivation there after he held onto the car and all that sort of rubbish. You know,
Vuelta. Yeah. Disqualification is what you're referring to there.
I am, yeah. He didn't make many friends at the end of the season, and, you know, he was rightly criticised and punished, I think, for that. But he showed once again that when he does have determination, he has the backing of the team as well. I think it's worth noting that Mikel Landa was pretty special for him in that Lombardy win.
Diego Rosa was up there as well. Now, was he... He's first year at Astana, first year on a big team, really. Obviously a talented rider. Is there a suspicion that he perhaps is slightly focused on personal goals as well, maybe?
I don't think you can particularly level that at him, given the season that he's done. He was excellent in the Giro at the start of the year, really rolled well for Fabio Aru, with whom I think he gets on quite well. I think we saw that in, was it Milan Turin the other day? Rosa's a local lad, he's from Piemonte, where Turin is. So first ever pro win, that was a big one for him. Aru sort of kept the rest of the peloton behind, rather like we saw Philippe Gilbert do in Brabantse-Pale for his teammate Hermans early in the year. And on Sunday, yeah, he could have had his own opportunities, probably riding well enough to have won it if he was up there. But he did some good work, helped Nibali, and Nibali, well, put the perfect end to a very, very difficult season in which he didn't have too many wins, but a couple of big and important ones.
Yeah, and a pick-me-up for the Astana team as well, who've had yet more bad news this week with the announcement that Alexander Vinokourov and Alexander Kolobnev, who may or may not have colluded to arrange the result of Liège-Bastogne-Liège a few years ago, the news is that there's going to be a civil proceeding against them in the Belgian courts, basically. I mean, a staggering development, really, in terms of bike racing. And, you know, collusion between riders is officially against the rules, but cooperation isn't. And if you were to take that case of the Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the allegation is that, effectively, Alexander Vinokourov bought it from Kolobnev. Sold it to Kolobnev.
Bought it from Kolobnev, yes, sorry.
I'm mixing up my alleged race-fixing, because this is the thing, you know, one of the things about when I got interested in cycling in the 80s was that this sort of collusion, the buying and selling of races, trading races, if you like, was part of the sport. It was just below the surface. It was kind of the underbelly of the sport. And I don't think at that time there was anything untoward about it, really. It was part of the negotiations out on the road. Riders from rival teams would work together or work against other people. Riders who might be transferring to another team may cooperate together. I mean, there's a very famous example.
So that's what Lionel thinks of the Tour Lombardy.
Well, the Tour of Well,
no, listen, I was going to say one thing on this before you give us your analysis on the Tour of Lombardy and give us your one famous example as well. That this was a question David Miller was asked about on our book tour last week, and he revealed to an audience, so I feel like I can reveal it on the podcast, that in 2003 at the World Championships in Hamilton, he was offered a lot of money to work for the Italian team, which is interesting. And a couple of years later, a couple of British riders, Charlie Wigelius, Tom Southern, did work for the Italian team and ended up in a lot of trouble. But Miller said he was offered a lot of money to help Bettini 2003 and he turned it down.
Well, that's one of the factors of the World Championships, isn't it? Riders from small nations who maybe don't have a big team or a clear objective in the race are, you know, they're up for grabs, and they have been historically, you know, and money...
Bernie Eisel at the Olympics doing a bit of work.
But let's be clear that we're not alleging that any money changed hands. No. These alliances can be owed to trade teams rather than the money changing hands.
Of course they can, yeah, and it happens all the time. But again, to suddenly bring such a thing into court is very strange. Yeah, I guess the way the sport's paid, the way the sport is arranged financially has changed, and you could say that ethically, where you sometimes thought it was okay to turn a blind eye to money changing hands because that's how guys made their money, with the wages that a lot of the guys are paid now, perhaps, as you know, Lionel was just saying, this case coming to court could be a real game changer.
Well, yeah, I think the thing that's happened in recent years is the fact that races can be gambled on quite widely. You know, a lot of bookmakers offering odds on races, and I think once you open Pandora's box and admit that there can be business deals done on the road, you know, that's the thin end of a pretty difficult wedge. But if you're going to take precedent, then many of the classics in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, would have been subject to a deal or two being done on the road. Not necessarily with money changing hands always, although there are one or two famous examples of that having been the case. One being the Tour of Lombardy in, I think it was 1986, or it might have been 85 actually, but Sean Kelly was in a break with Acacio da Silva, one of his teammates, a few other riders, and an Italian called Baron Kelly, Giambattista Baron Kelly. And Baron Kelly didn't have a contract for the following year, and he was in negotiations with a team, I think the Del Tongo team, for the following year, needed a big win to clinch that. He basically went round and bought up the group using the salary he anticipated he would get, and Baron Kelly won the race. Sean Kelly and others benefited from that, and Baron Kelly got his contract.
Everyone was happy,
and you can debate the rights or wrongs.
Well, I don't think
now.
You can debate. Yeah, I mean, it's wrong. It's wrong. I think it is wrong.
It is wrong. In the modern.
No, it's wrong. It's wrong. It's not right. Therefore, it's wrong.
Yeah, completely. I agree with you, but the problem is,
I can't believe, Lionel, you're an apologist for buying and selling races.
I'm not an apologist for buying or selling races, but if you're going to pick away at that scab, you've got to go back to the 40s, 50s. You've got, you know, you might uncover some really unpalatable truth.
It was part of the Cirque report as well, of course, with Lance Armstrong and, you know, allegedly buying races back. But let's get back to the Tour of Lombardy. Can we go back to the Tour of Lombardy, please?
To make one point on that, on the buying and selling races, the conversations I've had with Sean Kelly about it, you can't sell something you don't own. You know, until you all cross the line, you know, nobody's won the race. And so, yeah, if you if somebody's offering you money not to chase or not to...
I agree. It can be part of the game where a deal can be done and then rescinded. You know, I mean, somebody can do a deal to, in inverted commas, sell the race and then sprint anyway. It happened in the Australian Championship a few years ago with a rider from a small team who was away with two riders from the same team. Agreed a deal with them and then sprinted and won the race anyway. There's a lot of unhappy people, but, you know.
It's a can of worms, but I don't think that, you know, the example of Vinokourov and Kolobnev is one. It's in a modern-day context, and you... Whether or not
where there are bank records and they've been, you know, the payment has apparently been tracked.
Yeah, the money wasn't handed over in a carrier bag as has happened in the past. But like I say, you know, it's difficult to apply the same standard to two, three, 4 decades ago because the landscape of professional cycling was completely different then. But now, you're quite right, it's going through the courts and there will be an outcome and it may well focus a few people's minds.
It may well. Tour of Lombardy was at the weekend and Vincenzo Nibali won the race, rescued his season. It was a fantastic win, full of panache. Well, he tacked first on the penultimate climb, didn't get away or got brought back. Thibaut Pinot actually was very impressive. Then he got away on the descent and just enough for the final climb to hold on, although Dani Moreno got pretty close at one point. I was impressed with Thibaut Pinot. He was third in the race, rode quite aggressively. But you look at the roads there, the course there, for him, with the problems he's had in the past of descending, to survive on those, we saw the way that Nibali took the descents, it was sort of hair-raising stuff. So a very good ride, I think, by Pinot. Any other conclusions from Lombardy? Lionel, what are your thoughts on the Tour of Lombardy? I mean, what Nibali, everybody else, what did you think?
Well, for Nibali, it is a course made for him, as you say. The descents are as decisive as the climbs, and once he'd got over the top and was able to, you know, press home his advantage, the gap was going up. For Nibali, it's a kind of it is a victory of redemption for him. It's not been the best late summer for him. As a race itself, I always feel like it's a very small group of potential winners, a very small group of really interested parties in the race, and you see that cream rise to the top over the climbs. Moreno showed well in the Worlds, didn't he? You're right, Pino, you know, to do well in a big one-day race like that, you know, he's adding all of the time to his skills, isn't he?
I think Pino's maybe a future Liège-Bastogne-Liège winner, perhaps. I mean, you forget how young he is. He seems to have been around a few years, but he's only 25 still. There are signs of progress, signs of improvement all the time. Rob?
Yeah, fantastically aggressive. That was good to see him like that, actually. Racing with quite a bit of know-how, as I said, aggression. Obviously had the form as well. And for me, Lombardy always comes down to desire. It's that time of the season when Malpensa Airport's only just down the road, isn't it? Everyone wants to get on a flight to Abu Dhabi this week, have their gala dinner, have a few beers, ride around the Middle East in the sunshine and do what they have to do. You've got to really want to race and win that race. Thankfully, yesterday the weather, I'm talking here on Monday, of course, the weather was fantastic in Lombardy. Not always the case, which usually makes it even more difficult to win. You usually see half the field climb off on the way down. I said the airport's down the road. It's easy just to, all right, that's my season, done now, let's go on holiday. The guys at the top were the guys who are generally aggressive throughout the year. Valverde, again, has his detractors for obvious reasons, but races like really nobody else races, and we've seen that with him winning the World Tour yet again. And I think you were saying, Lionel, by an absolute country mile this year. He's stronger than everybody else, as Movistar have taken the team rankings, despite Sky having more victories in terms of numbers on the World Tour this year. But it was good to see the cream rising to the top, and yeah, all the guys you probably expected to be up there were up there, I think.
Yeah, World Tour. We've had a few requests for discussion on the World Tour and the World Tour rankings. Valverde is the winner, Movistar the team winner. Lionel, you interested in the World Tour rankings?
Not really. I don't want to sort of dismiss it out of hand, but the constant search for a season-long ranking system that actually means something in cycling, it's another kind of decades-long, fruitless pursuit, really. And I think that perhaps we should just abandon it. And I think the UCI have got some plans that they're hatching at the moment whereby the rankings might be split down so that there's a ranking to find the best sprinter, the best climber, the best time trialist, and perhaps then the best overall rider. But I think the fundamental problem with cycling and trying to crown the best rider of the year with a ranking system is that, one, you're comparing apples and oranges. There's no similarity between the one-day classics themselves. The Tour of Flanders is completely different to the Amstel Gold Race, or Paris-Roubaix is completely different to the Tour of Lombardy. Then you throw in the Grand Tours, which suit different riders again. The week-long stage races, which I think, the points weighting is completely wrong, because you get disproportionately rewarded for finishing in the top sort of five of a week-long stage race like the Tour of Catalonia or, you know, the Tour of the Basque Country or whatever. And the history of professional cycling has always had some kind of overall classification. If you go back to the Super Prestige Pernod Trophy, which was started in, I think, 1958, that lasted for 30 years. I think it stopped in 1988 or 87. That was a season-long ranking which rewarded consistency in stage races and one-day races. And it was quite prestigious because the Pernod company, the alcoholic drink manufacturer, put up a significant prize.
And also because in those days, riders tended to ride all the races. You
Absolutely.
Know, you had the Tour de France winner riding Paris-Roubaix, Tour of Flanders, Tour of Lombardy. I remember Greg LeMond, Sean Kelly being in contention at the Tour of Lombardy for the Super Prestige Pernod.
Well, once again, talking about the Tour of Lombardy and Rob's point about how you have to be really motivated. Back in those days, in the 80s, you know, you wouldn't be wouldn't be surprising if only sort of 40 or 50 riders finished. The only people who were contesting it were people who were going for the win, and people were trying to score points in the Super Prestige. And I think there was one year in the mid-80s where, you know, Kelly and Phil Anderson were going neck and neck, and it all came down to the last race. And that skewed the actual outcome of the, or that skewed the way the race itself was contested. The UCI in 1984 invented a computerised ranking. It was the Federation of International Cycliste Professionnel, FICP, world ranking. That came in 1984, and it evolved. It again awarded points for, you know, the top 10 positions, the top 20 positions or whatever. And over time, your points from the previous year halved in value, and you carried them forwards. And again, that crowned Sean Kelly as the champion for 5 or 6 years in a row. And since then, we've had the World Cup and now the World Tour, and they all seem to do the same thing. They reward the most consistent rider of the year, in this case, Alejandro Valverde, but not necessarily the best.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Yeah, we were talking there, Lionel, about the quest to recognise and honour the world's best rider. We also have the World Road Race Championship, which I think has done a pretty good job this year in recognising Peter Sagan.
Well, what do you think? I mean, do you think that there's any future in the World Tour as it currently is? What's the kind of the point of it? I mean,
we don't know. For something that we're not that interested in, we're talking about it quite a lot, aren't we?
For me, the World Tour does have a place, and I'm speaking with sort of my television hat on right now, because we need something to get people into the
listeners
sport.
I can confirm he is indeed speaking with his television hat on at the moment.
Nice,
he just put it on during the break there.
It's very nice, isn't it?
Lovely hat.
Yeah, we need
chapeau.
We need something, but it needs huge reform. It needs centralised graphics, it needs the same TV production, it needs an identity. At the minute, the World Tour doesn't have an identity, and I thought Lionel sort of illustrated that point very well in saying we don't really know what it's for. We need it, but we need to decide what it's for. It needs to be planned better, and it needs to be presented better to the world.
Let's move on from that and talk about Marcel Kittel, who has confirmed that he is indeed, as the rumours have suggested the last few weeks, joining Etix Quickstep Lidl. David Miller, last week, we're not sure, they announced Lidl as their new sponsor last week, not sure where they're going to fit in. David Miller suggested that they could have a very good sort of retro 70s style kit if they really went for the Lidl colours and design, with the blue, the bright blue, the yellow, the red, potentially quite nice, but I don't think they're going to do that, are they?
No, Marcel Kittel on supermarket sweep might be the next big thing, I don't know.
Yeah, Kittel, I mean, he moves from a team sponsored by a shampoo company. He presumably one of their primary assets with his Barnet. After the year he's had, it does suggest that there's been more to his terrible year than perhaps meets the eye. Daniel Freeb tweeted a great line from the Giant Alpecin press release announcing that Kittel was going to leave, that, you know, he's chosen to leave our high performance development program for pastures. Knew it was slightly bitter. So no love lost there, I don't think.
No, I think this has been building for a while, and I think we're privileged enough to hear little rumblings over the last few weeks what might not happen. We knew that somebody had a story, but it couldn't quite be released for different reasons. And the story this morning has eventually been confirmed, with Etix confirming that they've signed Marcel Kittel. It's pretty clear that somebody's fallen out big style somewhere along the line. That press release, as you were saying, that Daniel quoted, was very bitter. They'd had enough. It was almost as if he didn't want to continue his development. He didn't want to get better anymore by moving to another team, because they were talking up their own development systems and how good we are at developing riders, which has been proved true in the last few years. We've seen it with Tom Dumoulin this year in the Vuelta, Degenkolb and Kittel down the last few years as well. So they have a point. But also, naturally, if there has been a falling out, that Kittel does want to move on. And I would say now that he's in one of the best places, isn't he?
Well, I think that despite his bad year this year, Marcel Kittel's profile and market value has outgrown Giant Alpecin, and unfortunately Giant Alpecin haven't got the money to keep him. Although he was under contract, he's been able to negotiate his way out of that, and I would assume for an awful lot more money. And that's one of the difficult things about cycling, isn't it? It's all very well saying, well, he's under contract, but if he goes through another year effectively being underpaid, does that serve Giant Alpecin's interests anyway? And, you know, certainly the emergence of Tom Dumoulin has given Giant Alpecin a different slant. The interesting one for me is, where does this leave John Degenkolb, who is contracted to Giant Alpecin for next year and is staying, but has been very much on Patrick Lefebvre's radar as well? So whether Degenkolb will end up there at the end of next year, we'll have to see.
Embarrassment of riches, really, aren't there?
Well, that would tie in with Tom Bonham potentially retiring at the end of the year as well. That could be a like-for-like replacement, really. We'll have to see. The interesting thing for me with Kittel at the minute is where it's going to fit in with staff and Mark Cavendish's old set of staff, really. Is it going to fit in with them? The talk at the moment is that Brian Holm is very likely staying. Mark Cavendish's favoured director sportif, of course, best man at his wedding and all that sort of stuff. He is said to be staying with Etix Quickstep. And that could present a very, very unusual dilemma, even extra bit of pressure for Cavendish next year, as if he needs it already. I mean, you know, it's been a very difficult time for him. Although I think he's actually had a pretty decent year, Mark Cavendish. I don't think it's been anywhere near as bad as some people in the press are suggesting. He's had quite a lot of wins. When he hasn't been injured, he has been winning. But Brian Holm and Marcel Kittel up against Mark Cavendish next year could be a very, very tasty proposition, I think.
Very tasty indeed, yeah. It's fascinating. I mean, it's not... How will Mark Cavendish be feeling about effectively being replaced by his nemesis, Kittel? I mean, not nemesis, there's no sort of open hostility between them. They get on pretty well by all appearances, but I think beneath the surface there's inevitably a bit of rivalry, stroke jealousy there.
Well, we sort of heard this building up and rumbling up, the problems with Kittel over the last few weeks and maybe even a couple of months as well. How much did Mark Cavendish know that this was going to happen? He said to have left the team on very good terms with Patrick Lefebvre, tweeting each other. It was almost a mutual appreciation society on Twitter last week. Very, very nice and amicable between them. But did Cavendish know that Lefebvre obviously has been working on this for some time, because it's not the sort of thing that happens from one day to the next, is it? These deals are worked on. They've got things to be ironed out. And I understand that there are still things to be ironed out. There's talk even that Ralf Aldag could leave Etix Quickstep and could yet go to work with Mark Cavendish. He supposedly hasn't decided which way to go yet, so it's still uncertain. It might provide us with something else to talk about in the next couple of weeks as well.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Sorry, what was that, Lionel?
Well, Marcel Kittel from Giant to Lidl in one day. Quite a transformation.
Yeah. Okay. You heard our little.
You laughed at that when it was off air, and then when it's on air, you just sort of you let it fall flat.
I think
I can hear the guffawing from listeners out there. I'm sure.
I'm just.
Tumbleweed.
Yeah. We heard there our little British Eurosport jingle. Thank you very much, British Eurosport, for their continuing sponsorship of their podcast. Coming up on British Eurosport, the new Abu Dhabi tour, stage one is live, and 2, 3, and 4 are on repeat. So. That's coming up on British Eurosport. That race begins on Thursday, the 8th of October. Sunday, the 11th of October, live Paris Tours. Rob, you're nodding vigorously there. Are you commentating on
yes,
that?
Yes. Matt Stevens joins me for Paris Tour on Sunday. But as you said, Abu Dhabi throughout the week as well.
And then also coming up later in the month, the European Track Championships live. Also, starting on the final day of the European Track Championships is the London 6-Day. That's a new event. In next week's podcast, we will be doing a special preview of that and a bit of a a feature on 6 Day Racing, interviewing some 6 Day luminaries. Little reminder that we are doing an event on Sunday the 15th of November at the London Sports Writing Festival. Come and see the Cycling Podcast live. That'll be myself, Lionel and Daniel Freeb back from Berlin. That's from 2 to 3pm at Lord's Cricket Ground. Go on the London Sports Writing Festival website for tickets for that. It'll be recorded and released as a Friends special podcast. So just finally, in today's episode, as I mentioned earlier, I was on tour last week with David Miller. I don't know if any of you guys have had a chance to have a look at David Miller's book yet, have you?
No, I'm off down to the bookshop after this to have a look myself.
Lionel?
Yeah, I have, yeah. It's very engagingly written. It's very short. It's not sort of long chapters, is it? It's very short little vignettes which all kind of knit together. Really sort of captivated by the pace of how it's written so far. So, yeah, enjoying it.
Yeah, it covers, obviously, his huge disappointment in the middle of his final year when he was deselected from the Tour de France. That takes up quite a chunk of the middle part of the book, obviously, huge disappointment. But it ends on a high note at the Vuelta, which is quite an entertaining chapter. It's also interspersed with postcards that he's written to his two sons, Archibald and Harvey, from races. He began doing that as soon as his first son was born, actually, and he's now got hundreds of postcards, and they provide little diary entries from the races, which are quite nice to read as well. So, as I said, the full chat with David Miller will be released as a Friends special podcast sometime in the coming weeks. But here's a taster from an event we did in Manchester. It's me in conversation with David Miller.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Download old episodes absolutely free at thecyclingpodcast.com.
What do you miss most, the camaraderie or the feeling as a professional athlete of being so in tune with your body and being in that state of incredible physical fitness?
Yeah, I miss both of those probably equally, because the physical thing, which is weird, which I have to try and remember, I didn't necessarily write about it in this, but when I was at my very fittest, I was a miserable human being off the bike. Like it was, I was just slow. And that's one of the things all pro cyclists have. When we're at our fittest, we economize the whole time off the bike. Our life becomes just racing. And it says that's that Steve McQueen quote. It's like, if you're not racing, you're waiting. And that's very much what pro cyclists are. And that's not because we're cool like Steve McQueen. It's more that kind of, we push our bodies to such a degree that, and I've had it, and I see it time and time again, when we're at our best, we are only at our best on our bikes after 2 or 3 hours of racing, then we start to kick in. It's a f***ing misery. Sorry about the podcast.
I think the bleep man will be busy.
But I miss that. But then the camaraderie is something else. That's, I treasure that. Like I never anticipated going into professional cycling, so I was very selfish and obsessed and driven regards being a successful professional cyclist. I thought professional cycling was a bit dorky. You had to shave your legs. I came from BMXing, mountain biking. I did these things. And yet my best friends in the world now are my old teammates, and I love them to death. They're like my old school friends, my old university friends, my family, my cousins.
That sweet spot that you describe of, you know, great form, where it's almost like you're scared to lose it, you know, by expending too much energy off the bike. There's a really interesting bit at the start of the book where you talk about when you turned pro and speaking to Tony Rominger, who was just retiring as you were turning pro. And, you know, very successful, multiple Tour of Italy, Vuelta winner. And he told you that the difficulty in retiring was that a professional cyclist, unlike other sports people, maybe more skills-based sports, that the magic goes, the magic, you know, a retired footballer, David Beckham or somebody walking along the park, if a ball rolls towards him, he can flick it up. You know, that old magic is still there. Professional cyclists are a bit different. You don't retain that skill unless you work as hard at it as you do as a professional.
No, we don't. And it's like, kind of, I think that's probably one of the things that contributes to the emails I had from another ex-great Scottish pro cyclist. And
who would that be, David?
Another Miller, actually.
It does narrow it down a little bit. Yeah.
And Dave Zabriskie, and it's that sense of, you never realise when you're in it. I think that's my friends have always been those guys. They never had these big egos. They were kind of, they were in it. They loved it. They did it for passion. And you do take it for granted to a certain degree. And then all of a sudden it goes and you realise, oh man, I was actually really good at that. But what you were good at was training and working. And we and this is what I kind of talk about as well. We were born with a genetic gift to recover quickly and have massive endurance capabilities. And we were lucky enough to find a sport that kind of gave us that vehicle to exploit our natural abilities. Those natural abilities, professional cycling is essentially an ultra-endurance sport. And so when we stop training, we lose the magic. We still ride bikes, but isn't that, we will never get that, like you said, like an ex-footballer walking through a park with his son and a football comes across and they can do something magic with it. A golfer that can go to any course, a tennis player that can go to Masters across the world and kind of do exhibition matches, a racing driver that can get into any car still and still have the touch, next motorbike rider. They're technique sports with a mass amount of training as well. For us, it just goes. And so I think that's probably what's quite hard for us to deal with.
Because, I mean, if you were to go riding with half people in this room, they'd probably drop you at the moment, eh?
They would.
Really let himself go.
100%
Well, okay, all right, unless you're on a skateboard, obviously. I mean, you talk in the book about the necessary selfishness of being a professional cyclist. And how that became more difficult when you became a father in particular. But that selfishness, that drive, that focus, inward focus, is necessary. And so therefore it's justifiable. Even if it does drive your wife mad, it's necessary and you can justify it.
I admire it. I mean, I've seen it and I've had it. I could do it in phases, but I do admire. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. From what we see from the outside, the perception for people who don't live in it, you see these athletes achieve these great things over and over again. They're generally not necessarily very empathetic people. They're not the nicest people in the world. They're very self-obsessed. They have an intelligence that persuades people, but it's more through their success that allows it to persuade. So I think it's a strange thing because I do think some of the loveliest people I've met in the sport, they've actually cared about other things, but they've had the talents and gone through. But it is something I do admire, the fact that in order to be an alpha, super elite cyclist or any athlete, you have to be a bit of a...
I knew you were going to swear again at that point. It could have been worse. What I was getting to was how do you then change as a person when you retire, when you don't have that excuse anymore? You presume, have you had to become a different person? Is that something that you found quite easy to adapt to? Should we ask your wife about Nicole about that?
Oh, she's wonderful. She puts up with kind of this stuff. She kind of, she's on the long game. It's going to be fine one day. But no, I can tell you an email that I sent to Dave Zabriskie, one of my ex-teammates, an American rider, a couple of days ago because I was trying to get an email of somebody we know that I'd lost. And I sent a little email, and at the end of it, I put, how are you getting on? Because we'd had an email exchange about a year ago, and he said how hard he was finding retirement and this and that. And being men, I didn't respond to it. I waited a year when I needed something from him, then asked him. And he just replied with, I think this email works. And then afterwards, I still don't know yet. And that really sums it up. He just has no idea yet, like how he is, because you don't know anymore kind of what. You've lost everything you've done since you were a kid, all these fixed goals, this calendar race year, these objectives of people. You're treated differently by people because you're doing something that is quite special, but you never really expected it to be like that. And then it all stops, and then you're supposed to just fit back into doing what you've never done before. We're basically teenagers.
I mean, I should say that I have said already that the book is excellent. And what David is very good at is immersing you in the world of professional cycling and really taking you inside that world, but also being detached from it in order to recognise the absurdity of it. That, you know, and that's quite a rare gift to have. Are you aware of that? Do you think that that's, do you recognise that in yourself?
Yeah, I do, and I think that's one of the reasons that I ended up deciding, because I still have... My body could have kept going for 3 or 4 years. My mind lost it because I started to see it through a grown-up's eyes and start to see just, like, what are you doing to yourself? And that was very much helped by working on the Stephen Frears film, The Programme, the Lance Armstrong biopic that's coming out. Because then I was working with all these hyper-professionals that were working on trying to break down our sport, and I was having to explain to them, break it down to them, what our sport was, and show them things and talk them through it. And they would just look at me just going, what? And it would be, and I took Ben Foster, and he came to, who's the guy who plays Lance Armstrong, and he came to Colorado. He came there for 2 days to meet me, and he hadn't even signed up for the film. And I hadn't signed up for the film at that point. We were checking out things. And he came for 2 days to have a look, and he ended up staying the full week in full immersion, because he was like, this is amazing. It's like, he was in the car, and he's like, you guys come back to the car, and you take bottles, and you put them down your jersey, and you do this, and you hold it in the car. Guys crash, and they get back up. They get back up really quickly. And I was like, well, yeah, man, that's what we do. And it was like, for the first time I was looking, I was going, oh, yeah, this is a bit weird, actually, our sport. And he's like, you race for 5 hours? Yeah, kind of every day. And so it was kind of, that was where it started. And that was where I started for the first time to detach myself and started to realise what I'd taken for granted.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/SPC to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
Okay, you heard our extended jingle there for Trainer Road, our new sponsor. Well, been sponsored for a few weeks now. I feel new because we've not started our Trainer Road programs yet, but that's coming imminently.
Yeah, we've received the email, haven't we, with our instructions. We've got to get on our bikes, chaps, and start training. And basically, it's all about improving and being the best we can be in the time available. Is that right?
Yeah, I've never done anything like this before, but Trainer Road, you pay a monthly subscription, you are trained remotely. The coach Chad will be coming on the podcast to give us little updates on how we're getting on. It's a new thing for me. Rob, you're going to be taking part in this as well?
Yeah, is he going to be like a PE teacher where he sort of embarrasses you in public and gets you out there? Is that why you went out riding yesterday so early in the morning on a Sunday?
Yeah, probably that's how it's going to work, Rob. Yeah, I hope that's okay.
But I think we all probably, with our sort of busy lives and lack of kind of motivation.
Discipline, structure.
Yeah, we all need that. We need something pushing us to... get out on our bikes, don't we? Otherwise, it just all sort of drifts along and you lose fitness, particularly as the winter months are coming. I'm looking forward to this being the catalyst to get fitter than I've been for quite some time.
I'm looking forward to it. And it's been nice, since we announced this tie-up with Trainer Road, to have a lot of very positive responses from listeners who clearly are already Trainer Road customers and say very good things about them. So that's nice to hear. And we'll be reporting back on how we get on over the coming weeks and months. Something to look forward to. We'll all be shadows of our former selves, I think, won't we? There'll be no more milky coffees. We'll be on fruit juice and
skinny
mineral water.
Chino things, yeah. Something like that.
Anyway, listen, let's wrap it up for this week. We'll be back next week talking no doubt about Paris Tours and other things that are going on. Also looking ahead to the London 60. In the meantime, Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.